Brian Had a Dream. 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
Hi, I'm Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And welcome once again to the quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. In this episode, it's good to be the king, Stephen King, that is. Has there been another author with so many adaptations into the world of film? And what about his latest movie, It, and how that's doing in the box office? So we'll talk Stephen King in this episode, and list off Brian's top five Stephen King adaptations. We would like you to join the conversation on Twitter at 10K Movies. That's T-E-N-K Movies, or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. But before we get to that big topic and top five, as always, Brian, we start out with where you are currently on your quest.
8,269.
And the last movie you saw was?
A film noirish movie from the late 1930s, The Roaring Twenties, starring Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney.
And what did you think of that movie?
Pretty good. I mean, the two of them, you know, they're two all-time great. They were in three movies together. This was the final of the three. And so often in early movies in his career, Bogart is the heavy. He's a bad guy. And they're both gangsters, of course. I mean, what else would you expect? And it was good. I mean, basically, they came back from World War One, and Cagney's character, they were both changed by their experience in France. And Bogart's character was hardened and went to becoming a bootlegger. Cagney's character couldn't get his job back, even though it was promised to him. The guy's like, what am I supposed to do? This other guy's been here 2 years. I can't fire him now. It's like, but you promised me I could have my – sorry, I'm the brakes. You know, it's kind of a harsh reality for the way it was for so many people coming back from war in that adjustment period. But they both get involved in bootlegging and become gangsters. And then – but it's a good movie. It's a good movie.
So you've mentioned on our podcast a number of times different platforms you use to watch your films.
Uh-huh.
What have you been using lately? Where'd you see this movie on?
Well, I watched it on TCM, Turner Classic Movies. Luckily, we have a thing with our DVR now where I can, through DirecTV, I can watch what I've recorded on my DVR mobily. So I recorded it on TCM and watched it DirecTV.
So any other movies you want to mention at this point?
Well, I did catch a relatively new movie, Baby Driver, and it was good. It wasn't great. I mean, it was kind of predictable. I didn't think it was anything super special, but I mean, it was enjoyable, but it wasn't like earth-shatteringly good or anything like that. I think my initial reaction was, I think I told somebody, it's like all substance, all style over substance, but when the style is pretty good, nobody seems to care.
Right. It's a movie that's gotten a lot of buzz, and that's maybe a good segue into probably the movie that took the buzz into now the fall, from the summer into the fall. Stephen King's It, and this is kind of what has prompted this discussion for us. Now, maybe before we talk about Stephen King and what makes King a writer whose material seems to be just always ripe for adaptation into film and television, we'll spend just a little bit more time talking about the project of King's that failed miserably this summer.
Yeah.
The Dark Tower. And the reason that one comes to mind is because in our last episode, we also talked about Auburn football and how that was starting in our football and movies podcast episode. And how we might talk about Auburn football a little bit. And I'll tell you, Brian, I don't want to spend too long on this.
Yeah.
But it kind of reminded me
of the Dark Tower.
Auburn's game against Clemson kind of reminded me of the Dark Tower. And that it showed some promise.
Yeah.
Really kind of excited for it. By the end, I was kind of like,
there was some cool casting in the off season, like Jared Stidham, a great cast choice.
Yeah, and Matthew McConaughey, Idris Elba, strong performances, the defense. those sorts of things. But the more I think about it, just the madder I tend to get, and I don't want to waste that much emotional energy either on dissecting that Auburn-Clemson game or on the Dark Tower. So that's just something I thought would be
which is
helpful.
which is sad because I don't know that I've read all of the books. I know you have, and so I know you've spent a good portion of time and emotional energy already invested in this world. So it's just sad that the movie, you know, it when a movie that obviously resonates with so many people so much, when it fails to really capture why they were so invested in the world to begin with, that's very sad to me.
That's true, but it's, you know, like I said, I don't want to talk about Dark Tower much, but it does maybe point us now towards a larger conversation, which is King is a writer who he's been active.
It's a factory. And he's just constantly turning. I mean, he's been writing now since the mid, well, probably since the late 60s.
Past 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
He's been writing. And
pretty much putting out one or two novels a year. And, you know, now for the longest time, there are still some literary elitists that would say he's not real literature, you know, that they would thumb their nose down at King. But I will say this, because I think this is where I'm at. Roger Ebert, who I really adore and really, you know, look to him as a guiding light in some ways, and has had a really big impact on me. He was writing about Stephen King, and he said, look, I used to be a snob about him too, but I read King's nonfiction work, his nonfiction book On Writing, which is his just a little, it's about 150 pages, maybe 200 pages of him musing on what makes a good writer and what sort of traits you should avoid. And I've read the book too. And he's right. You know, King is, he may choose to write in genres that are not particularly intellectually challenging or, you know, don't cater to elite tastes, but he often writes in other genres too. But he is, no one can doubt the man is extremely well-read, and he does, and his writing has evolved. He's constantly working at his craft. And what else could you ask for out of someone who makes writing their profession?
Do you think that sort of appeal maybe to, I won't say the lowest common denominator, I don't think that's what you're saying, but an appeal where, you know, he's kind of just writing for mass audience. Is it as simple as that? Is why his work is adapted?
But you know, I think what happens is you have people that just get invested in a certain sort of mindset about what literature should be, and part of that is because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, they want to be the gatekeepers to what's good and what's not. But you know, the same people that are saying King is to be denigrated because he writes to a mass audience fail to realize that a good portion of the people that were paying and coming to see Shakespeare were the lowest of the lows. Like, it was not something for the intellectual elite of the time. It was something for a mass audience. And so I'm in no way saying that 100 years from now people will know or care you know, about Christine or Cujo or Carrie, but I am saying that it's as much a possibility that people are going to care about Jonathan Franzen or they're going to care about Margaret Atwood. I can't sit here and tell you right now which artist's work will stand the test of time and which won't. But I can say that in the here and now, that to a certain extent, public opinion has definitely spoken, and King's 40 something plus, you know, career deserves some respect at least.
So what makes, I think, King also someone who is so prolific with material that can be converted into other mediums beyond just his books? I think two things. For a long time, he wrote a column, and he may still, I don't read the magazine.
Entertainment Weekly?
Right. He sort of embraces a lot of the pop culture stuff and unabashedly, unashamedly. Yeah,
that's right.
So,
that's right.
So I think there's not necessarily this sort of obsession with, oh, I got to have my films, my books in the pictures, but there's just this sense of like he genuinely sort of enjoys that and that process. And so I think there's a genuineness and maybe even something of an eye, even if it's kind of in just the back of his head when he's writing it. You know, how would this also translate to some other mediums? I think he just loves movies.
I think you're absolutely right. I think his stories, for the most part, are pretty straightforward. They don't require, the Dark Tower being an exception, I think. But even that, the basic premise of the story is not something that you need a lot of setup to understand.
Right. And you, that was going to be the second thing. I think a lot of his work would work really well as the elevator pitch. Because
like Cujo, Scary Dog. That movie is.
Strength is a writer's, exactly what you're saying, really kind of some maybe premises that do resonate with people. They're basic, not in a negative sense, but basic in that, again, relatable, but also kind of there's some creativity, there's some innovation, there's some things like that. And King's strength as a writer is in those plots, those premises, and the beginning of most of his written work. I've read a handful of King stories and books and novels and novellas, and he knows how to begin a work without a doubt. One of his weaknesses as a writer, people have leveled at them, and I can see this.
He doesn't know how to end.
He doesn't quite always stick the landing. Yeah. But you can see where someone who's so great at sort of, here's the premise, here it is, here's how it begins, you know, the man in
black. Yeah, they're all boiled down to like a one-sentence premise, and that's the whole premise. There's just one, it's like just one big idea. One of the things in his that I've read, and I don't know if this was in On Writing or another book that he's written, but he was talking about the craft of writing, and he's pretty strict about this. He said, if you're going to write for a profession, A, you got to set aside time and you got to write. You can't just play at it. But he said also, you have to also commit just as much time to reading, because he said, you can't be a writer if you don't, you're not also a reader. And while other artists sort of say that in a different way, whatever, he's one of the most simple about saying, and I find it to be genuine. He says he reads constantly. He said, I read 4 or 5 hours every day because I want to know how I can improve. And that's the way I improve, is by seeing stuff outside of my own limited, you know, my own vision. And you can see that. You can see that in his influences. And you can see that in why he loves pop culture so much, is because he's always trying to see and kind of find a new wellspring of ideas.
And I think the most obvious reason his work continues to get adapted, it's sort of like this, you know, the boulder rolling down the hill. It just continues to pick up momentum the more he writes.
Well, and I would say
the bigger his audience grows. And I think filmmakers see that, and they're like, there's a built-in audience for this already. Mm-hmm. There's something we can sell here.
Well, and the one thing, too, is unlike a lot of authors that have a passionate fan base, you know, like Tolkien, passionate fan base. I don't know how widespread the fan base is for Tolkien, or how widespread the fan base is for somebody like C.S. Lewis or even John Grisham or Nicholas Sparks. Have a fan base, and it's very passionate, but how wide is it? King's is incredibly wide. You know, over the past 40 years, there are very few people that enjoy writing on a serious, I mean, enjoy reading on a serious level, that have not read at least one book by Stephen King. I mean, it's impossible to have not, at least at some point, picked up and read something that the man has written. And because of that, I think that, he appeals to not just a small group of people in this part of the country or this age group. It's a wide variety of people that are at least somewhat familiar with what he's selling.
Now, neither one of us has seen the movie It. I'm not going to go see it. That is not anything that I really want to see. It's gotten great reviews so far.
Yeah.
It may be maybe is the highest grossing film
that's certainly possible
based on Stephen King's books. It may even be the most well-known, kind of most, you know, the book that got the most publicity paired with the movie adaptation that got the most publicity. Mm-hmm. Although I'd say you know, part of the fervor behind this film is because of how well the TV miniseries was loved by so many.
Yeah, and that's what I was
saying.
This
is the thing, but this is where I want to go with this sort of line of thought. What does it say, though, that it might actually be some of his lesser known kind of works that are maybe the better films of the
ones he's done? I want to briefly touch on the miniseries. I loved it when I was a kid, and I think a lot of people our age have incredibly fond memories of that idea of you know, Tim Curry as this creepy clown. I watched it a couple of years ago, and it doesn't hold up that well because it sort of drags. But I have extremely fond memories of it. But I'm going to say this about his movies, because I'm not going to give anything away about what I think about the top five movies he's done. But I think, based on what I noticed when I was ranking the ones I'd seen, his movies, when they are paired with a very strong, distinctive director, are excellent. When they are paired with someone who is maybe not as strong, or maybe somebody who's an up-and-coming director, or not as good. So I think his movies need somebody else to sort of channel that vision and sort of like cut it down and get rid of, because sometimes I think King can add some fluff that's unnecessary that needs to be sort of, you know, whittled away to where you get to the core of the story. His stories and his setups and his premises are incredibly creative and incredibly like connect with an audience. But sometimes the stuff around them distracts from that core. And I think that that's what somehow that's what translates to his best movies.
Well, let's go ahead and move in and talk about his best movies, at least according to your list. What would you consider the top five Stephen King adaptations? Okay. Are these, when you were doing your list, is this going to be just film or film and movies, miniseries?
Well, the It miniseries is eligible in this, and it's included, but it's not in the top five. And I'm going to briefly say, you know, my wife and I enjoyed the adaptation of his novel Under the Dome, the TV series, although it went beyond the scope of the book and got off the rails in its second season, which is why there's not a season three. And I enjoyed his the adaptation of his shorter book, 11/22/63, that was done for Hulu, starring James Franco. That was pretty good, and a departure from – but those as television series are not included in this list. Miniseries I'll include, television, but that's because it's my list and I can do what I want to. The rules. So coming in at number five, The Dead Zone. This is Christopher Walken. It's directed by a visually strong director, although maybe not as well of a storyteller, but David Cronenberg. That's my number five. I enjoyed it. But
can you think of a better actor to pair with
Stephen
King? I mean, both kind of eccentric, known for horror, but not just kind of horror, just kind of eerie kind of characters. Just kind of relish what they do.
Walken has a really weird look. Eerie. Yeah, yeah. Well, and number four, a movie that in a lot of ways defined this woman's career. And will define her career. Misery, with Kathy Bates and James Caan. While Kathy Bates is beloved and she's been in a lot of good stuff, I don't think she's going to scale those heights again. And I think in a lot of ways, most people, when they think, even people that haven't necessarily seen Misery, when you see her in a movie, that's your go-to like impression of her as this crazed fan who, you know, breaks a guy's legs in the middle of a cabin in the woods. That's what you think of. And that's 25 years ago.
Right. And that's a great example of a film, I think, where, you know, someone who is not a huge fan of King's, you know, when that movie came out, I mean, I remember that movie came out and it was almost like, oh, this is based on a Stephen King book. It kind of became an afterthought. It wasn't necessarily, you know, the first thing that you thought of or that people talked about, you know, with this movie.
Yeah, no.
And it speaks to, I think, yeah, this thing with the adaptations of King's books, where, you know, sometimes the story plot premise is so kind of front and center that you forget the person who.
Well, you know, and that's exactly right. Stephen King is a brand, but tell me, what are the distinctive characteristics of his brand other than he wrote them?
Yeah. I'd use that word again, eeriness, but yeah, horror maybe.
He's written a lot of horror, but I wouldn't even necessarily. I mean, Misery is a scary movie, but it's not really a horror movie because there's not like a supernatural force waiting around the corner. It's more about, and in some ways, it sort of predicts our increasing over reliance and obsession with finding out, you know, spoilers in a way, or the next thing coming up. That's what she wants. She wants to know the next story, you know, mm-hmm. and it sort of predicts our pop culture obsession or plays mm-hmm. into it. Right, we're moving on to number three. This is a great movie. The series of books I have read, The Green Mile. Love it. Love that movie. Okay. Love Tom Hanks in it. Love pretty much everything about the movie. It's a great movie.
I agree. I like it. I think the movie itself is a little bit long, which is why I think it's a good movie. I think there's flaws.
Well, now the books he wrote. Interesting thing about the Green Mile books is he wrote them as a serialized book, just because he's Stephen King and he can experiment and do whatever the hell he wants to. So he wanted to go back and write kind of like Charles Dickens was writing in the 18th, 19th century, and so he published six chapters, but one chapter like every 2 months. And he said, when the first book came out, I hadn't finished writing the sixth one. So I didn't know where the story was going and didn't know how it was going to get there. And I'm writing it, you know, sort of as I go. But the book is a good bit different from the movie. It's hard not to see the obvious religious symbolism of James Coffey. It's hard not to say. It's a little on the nose, but it's a great. Like the drink only spelled different. It's a good movie.
Well, and I think another, again, maybe common through line in the better films based on King's work is it does depart a lot from, again,
it does. Well,
the book series.
Well, you know, Misery, Rob Reiner, pretty strong director, pretty strong vision, you know, clout. Green Mile, Frank Darabont, who may be the perfect person to adapt Stephen King's work to the screen, because that leads us into number two, another Frank Darabont directed movie, which departs significantly, but is also based on a Stephen King short story, and that is The Shawshank Redemption.
And that is, to me, the quintessential example of, oh, Stephen King wrote this?
I mean, this is a collection of four short stories. Yeah, the story is like 20, 30, maybe 40 pages, and turns into one of the movies that just, for the average person, you know, if you press them to name their 10 top movies, I'd say most people, Shawshank's going to be in that top 10 somewhere.
Yeah. One of the most rewatchable movies.
Thanks to AMC, yeah.
TNT, TBS.
It's just taken on a pop culture, you know, thing, and where it's in the pantheon of great movies. In some ways may have, just like Misery, built Kathy Bates' career. You could argue Shawshank built Morgan Freeman's career. I mean, he was a good actor, but Shawshank sort of elevated him into like rare status. And also his voiceover in Shawshank is the reason we all want Morgan Freeman voicing over, you know, doing voiceovers for our everyday life, right?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, I think that movie's what made that connection. Like, that's the voice I want to hear. And it's just such a deep, moving, just wonderful movie. So many quotable lines and just... And you know, you got to give King credit because, I mean, it is his story. I haven't read the story. I don't know how much it departs, but I get the feeling that it departs quite a bit to expand.
There's some pretty significant differences. It's been a while since I read it. And it's actually part of a collection of short stories that includes a short story, The Body, which
was The Stand
by Me, is based on. And I read The Body, too, and I was like, oh, wait a second. That experience would be like Stand By Me was also Stephen King.
Yeah, it's like,
hey,
you can't.
Oh gosh, pretty close, but yeah, some particular differences, but I think, again, it's just surprising me that one of the most understated and overlooked King works is now one of the most well-known.
Oh, yeah.
In a different format.
Yeah, yeah.
So if that's your number two, I can't even
begin. Well, I think you may know what my number one is. I mean, because I've talked about my love of this movie. Maybe I haven't, but I love this movie, and not everyone will agree, but my number one is The Shining. I just blown away by it. I think it's Kubrick's best film. I know Stephen King hated the adaptation, which just says something to me. And I don't really get why he hated it, but I mean, it's his right to, like, you know, because he even went so far as to really spearhead a TV miniseries trying to, like, undo what he thought was the unfair adaptation that Stanley Kubrick had done to his beloved novel or whatever. But I love it. I love Jack Nicholson in it. I love Shelley Duvall in it. And I think it's a sublime piece of filmmaking. And it's a horror film, but it's not really, like, it's not a horror film in the same thread that, like, the movies based on the Ouija board or Paranormal Activity or Annabelle or whatever the horror movie du jour is right now. You know, it doesn't work quite that way.
I think what King does in those type of films, and The Shining is a perfect example of it.
You mean The Shining?
There's this eeriness, there's a supernatural element, but I think for King, part of the true horror is what human beings can do to other human beings.
Yeah.
And so he really kind of brings that out in The Shining.
Well, and my understanding of his writing of The Shining, it's a very personal book because a part of it is Jack Torrance is an alcoholic who's, you know, and at the time King was struggling with his own addictions, and it was sort of working his way, that sort of worked its way into his work because that's what, you know, he was living. I think it's very personal for that reason, but I think it's peak Jack Nicholson and peak Stanley Kubrick, which is, you know, obviously two of the greats of the 20th century. But that's my number one. And the distinction between it and Shawshank is not huge by any stretch of the imagination. But it's interesting, you know, my top five, at least two of my top five Stephen King movies have really nothing at all to do with the horror genre. They're not even a stretch could you say that these are horror movies. Two of the others you could make a case, but they're not necessarily even horror movies by conventional horror standards. I mean, you compare it to like Nightmare on Elm Street or Friday the 13th, and they're not the same. You couldn't reasonably say they're the same genre.
Yeah, well, listeners, tell us what you think of King's work in general, of movies, TV shows, miniseries based on Stephen King's work. There's tons that we have left out and probably failed.
There's like eight Children of the Corn movies, which is...
Let us know what you think on Twitter at 10kmovies or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. This episode is coming to you a little bit later than normal, and the next one possibly could come that way as well. We're still trying to keep to our every other week schedule, but sometimes life gets in the way, and sometimes we just need to read and do other things like Stephen King says to do if you're going to do other stuff. So thank you for sticking with us, and we will be back in another 2 weeks to talk about Oscar season and what seems to be coming down the road that way. Until then, we hope your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline
11.